This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Ray Kroc is the man who transformed McDonald's from a family restaurant in San Bernardino, California, to one of the biggest corporations in the world. His life, of course, a rags-to-riches story. As Ray raked in the billions, an enigmatic woman was giving much of it away. Joan Kroc was Ray's third wife, and when Ray died, she became heir to his seemingly endless fortune. In her book, Lisa Napoli explores what drove Joan Kroc's generosity. The book is called Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. And Lisa Napoli joins us from our studio in Greensboro. Lisa, so good to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk about this story, because when you started digging into Joan's story, you were actually working as a journalist at the public radio station KCRW, right, an NPR station in Santa Monica. Tell us how you first became interested in Joan Kroc.
Oh, it's such a crazy, strange story. I went to cover this peace sculpture that is 26 feet tall of a nuclear mushroom cloud made of chain link. And it was falling down, and the city of Santa Monica said it was going to knock it down because it didn't have the money to restore it. And peace activists were going crazy, as you might imagine. They wanted to preserve it. So I went to cover it with my microphone, and I said, you know, why don't you just go back to whoever paid for this in the first place to have them fund the restoration? And the person I was interviewing said, turn off your microphone. This is a secret. It was an anonymous gift by Joan Kroc. And of course, everyone at public radio hears her name all the time. And I thought, why would Joan Kroc give a sculpture here? And was she a peace activist? Because it was a very political piece of work. And sure enough, I looked for a biography and I couldn't find one. So I appointed myself biographer, which was kind of a zany thing to do. But
I mean, there's two fascinating points. Number one, that Joan Kroc would be the benefactor in this case. And as you say, this is a really highly charged kind of a political statement. But the two, that when you went to look for stories about her life and information, there was very little out there.
Yeah, and she really wanted it that way, Frank. That's what I found out. You know, at first I thought, well, this is, I'm indignant. How come this woman hasn't been celebrated? And then I found out pretty quickly that she didn't want to be celebrated. In fact, she trashed all of her papers when she died because she just didn't want to leave a mark. It's the same reason she trashed her foundation. She closed her formal foundation years before she died because she just didn't want to leave a legacy in that way. She just wanted to give the money away in the hands of people who would do good with it, but she didn't need the glory or the celebration. So it was fun. I felt like Sherlock Holmes for many years while I was digging out the story, because you had to go down so many different roads, and some people were willing to talk and others weren't. And it was always curious how to stitch together her life, because of course, in many ways, she was very public. It's hard to give lots of money away often and not, and keep it anonymous. And several times she did try to do that and it backfired on her. And of course, because she was attached to Ray Kroc, who was the celebrated CEO of his day, it was impossible to be so on the down low. But yeah, it made for interesting research.
And I want to we're going to get into her story, but I think this is the point at which we should point out that she gave an awful lot of that money, to over $230 million, to this this nonprofit called NPR that we're familiar with, right?
Yes.
So we'll tell more about that story, but I think that should be out front, and to the extent that full disclosure is necessary, there you have it. But now tell us about Joan's background and her upbringing. What was her life like as a little girl? What did you find out about her upbringing?
Well, she was very poor. She grew up very poor during the Depression and afterwards. Her family never was well-to-do. She longed for education, but she couldn't accomplish that because of her family means. And so she was a very skilled and talented pianist in St. Paul, Minnesota. And that was her bread and butter. She had a job playing on television in the early days of TV because she was very attractive, too, as well as very proficient on the keyboards. She also played in a restaurant, an elegant restaurant, during the dinner hour. Played organ back when people played the organ, and she gave lessons around town. So that was her ticket out of her day-to-day doldrums. And even as a young married woman, she got married very young. She had one child. She was sort of the main support of her young family with this musical work. And she always wanted something more. You know, some people just are born with this ambition to break out, not even just financially. She wanted a bigger life than than she had. And music was her first way out. And of course, that's how she met Ray, which really got her out of the situation that she was in.
Well, tell us about that meeting, because she was at that point playing organ at a fairly swank restaurant in St. Paul, right?
Yes, yes. The Criterion Restaurant was one of the fancy restaurants of its day. And Ray had come in. He was at that point in 1957, not wealthy. He was trouncing around the United States, mostly the Midwest at that point, looking for people who would buy franchises of McDonald's. And he went in to try to sell Jones' boss, a franchise. He was Jones' boss, Jim Zine, was a very enterprising serial entrepreneur. And he had heard about this 15-cent hamburger game. And Ray came in and saw Joan playing organ during the dinner hour. She was beautifully appointed, and he fell madly in love with her, not just because of her looks, but also because he was a pianist, too. And so he really saw and heard how great her skills were. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Oh, but let's unpack some of that history, because they were both married at the time and yes. When this romance began. So tell us more about that.
Yes. And he was 26 years older, and they didn't live in the same place. But the husband and wife they each had, of course, would be a major impediment to their love affair. And interestingly, and this was a really exciting day, the day I pieced this together, Ray not only did sell Joan's boss a franchise, he got the boss to hire Joan's husband to run it. And so that gave them a reason to be in touch, because Joan's husband, Raleigh, was running store number 93 in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And of course, that was a very early day of McDonald's. So people, you know, the corporate people were indelibly entwined with the people on the ground, the franchisees. And so that allowed Ray and Joan to bond over the building of the franchise. And ultimately, Joan's husband got his own franchises. Ray sent them to South Dakota, Rapid City, and they opened the first stores there. And McDonald's was through and through in her veins, ketchup in their veins, they call it, the McDonald's
hard
guys.
Hard to get that stuff out of your veins, too,
it's,
I guess.
Oh, yes.
but let's reiterate something here. Store number 93. So to reiterate what you said earlier, Ray Kroc is not a billionaire or even perhaps even a millionaire at this point. He is trying to become one of the most successful business, but he's not. He's not a gazillionaire at this point. They meet, and their romance goes for 12 years before they finally break a knot and tie a knot, right?
Yes. And by the in the meantime, he broke a knot, tied another knot, broke that knot, and finally married Joan. So this is a good juicy drama, but it's also juicy in the sense that, Frank, I grew up, of course, knowing that fast food was just this indelible part of our culture, like it or not. But what's so interesting about this story to me, maybe because I used to be a business reporter, is that fast food wasn't always a foregone conclusion in this country. And what happened is that McDonald's was one of many organizations, if you will, starting vying for our attention with food on the roadsides, the emerging post-World War II landscape of the United States. And so the story of McDonald's and Ray and Joan's relationship is sort of arced together, because as their relationship had all these twists and turns and dramas, McDonald's life, if you will, had all these twists and turns and dramas, because at many points it almost fell completely apart. Yes, it's curious and interesting that Joan didn't marry Ray until 1969, when McDonald's had gone public and Ray now was a firmly established multimillionaire.
So how much were you able to debunk? Because a lot of what we think we know about Ray's life anyway could come from the movie The Founder that was released last year. Certainly his story was widely circulated, and I think he had already become part of the canon of the great American myth by then. But this film tells the story of the original McDonald's franchise, which shows Ray as a kind of aggressive businessman. And again, the film really shows him as a swindler who kind of cheated Dick and Mac out of the two original owners of that San Bernardino store out of their ownership. But tell us more about that, and maybe what you found, and whether or not you found much of that was confirmed or not in your research.
The film is great, and it's very Hollywood in the sense that it sort of collapses and embellishes a lot of the history. And yes, while Ray was a super aggressive businessman, and he didn't particularly like the brothers McDonald, even though he convinced them to let him franchise their speedy service system of delivery of food and preparation of food, they were not cut out of the deal. They were actually very happy to ride off into the sunset in 1961 with a $2.7 million payout. And in fact, in those first years, since Ray had signed on as a franchisee in the mid-50s, the only people besides franchisees who were making money from the deal were the brothers McDonald's, because they had a nice fat royalty that they got a percentage of all the sales of all the stores. As stores kept coming online, they kept getting a piece of the action. And they traded that, which is not depicted correctly in the movie, they traded that for a lump sum payout to walk away from Ray, sold their name to Ray. And at that point, McDonald's as a corporation was still possibly on the brink of collapse. Not possibly. It was in very terrible financial straits. They had to beg and borrow the $2.7 million to pay off the brothers. And that tension doesn't come through in the film. It's easier just to depict them as bad guys versus bad guy, you know, right. A different bad guy, right? But or hapless guys versus bad guy. But it wasn't quite that simple.
Well, here's what I really want to know, because Joan shows up in this film at a business meeting with Ray Kroc. And it's in the film, she's the one who convinces him to make the ice creamless milkshake. I want to play the clip. Here's how it sounded.
It's a powdered milkshake. Costs a fraction of ice cream, and there's no refrigeration necessary.
It contains powdered milk. Thickening agents and emulsifiers simulate the texture of ice cream. Tastes just like the real thing.
It's easy as pie to make. You put a packet into a glass of water and stir it.
I know, maybe a tad blasphemous, what with your dairy background.
Personally, I think it's a marvelous idea.
There we go. That's a clip from the 2016 movie, The Founder, that tells the foundation of the McDonald's Corporation. So, was she the one? Do we have her to thank and blame?
Bunk, bunk, bunk. Okay. It's not true. Joan did a lot, but she had nothing to do with that. And in fact, what's interesting is that McDonald's, up until around the mid-60s, was all locally sourced food. And it was the milkshake machine mix and the frozen fries were trotted out to keep the standards of consistency that were necessary when McDonald's went public. Joan was not even involved with Ray at that point. I mean, she was involved from a distance, but that's all very sexy. And she looks very sexy in that scene where she's trying to convince him to do that.
They did get married, as you say, 1969. So this is after about 12 years of knowing each other. Talk about that relationship after their marriage. It was quite a ride.
Yes, you know, people who thought this was a fairy tale marriage were quickly proven wrong. She was 40 years old at the time. Ray was 66. And it became pretty clear to Joan, if it hadn't already, that Ray was a big drinker. And in fact, he was such a big drinker. He had such a violent and ungovernable temper that Joan threatened to divorce him. She actually filed divorce papers a couple of years later after their marriage, and she decided to stay. And that's always been a big mystery for me, exactly why. Even people very close to them weren't quite sure why she stayed, but she did. And that's when she sort of emerged as this philanthropist. And her first act of philanthropy was sort of thumbing her nose at Ray quietly by taking some of his money and starting one of the first alcoholism education programs in the country. And she never outed his secret until the end of his passing. But she worked diligently with her high school education to convene people who were early adopters of the alcoholism education movement. And she really worked very hard to do that. So they had a tempestuous relationship. He loved her. He put her on a pedestal, but he was also a very, very difficult person to live with.
And she gave away a lot of money to causes that he might not necessarily agree with.
Yeah, including the fact that he never saw himself as an alcoholic, and while he supported her Operation Cork efforts. After that, it was mostly after he died that Joan let her liberal stripes hang out. And liberal stripe is wrong, actually, because she was a registered independent, but she was a fierce no-nukes advocate, a passionate believer in free speech and democratic media. She was an early funder of the hospice movement, and many of the things that she did support were things. Ray was a very sort of classic conservative businessman. He'd given money to Nixon, and Joan was supporting Mondale. But she said she waited till he passed, till she really let her personal feelings come out. She didn't feel it was right. As feminist as she was, she didn't feel it was right to be that vocal while Ray was alive.
We talked about that $200 million plus donation to NPR, and there's a great story around that. Tell us how NPR came to be the beneficiary.
Well, Joan, as I say, loved free speech and media. She was a media junkie before, you know, we used that term. Always had the news on wherever she was and would switch the dial, change the channel in search of more. And she met Kevin Close, who then was the president of NPR, who was an impassioned steward of, I think you worked for him, right? He was an impassioned steward of not just NPR, but of the importance of free speech and media in a democratic society. And Joan just was so dazzled by him. He was a very dashing man, too, as well as very articulate. And she, at the end of her life, found a bank account that was, we should all have such problems with a lot of money in it.
Oh, I didn't know I had that one. How much
I
is in there?
I forgot that I had $230 million. Yeah. Whoops. And she had to make plans very quickly at the end of her life and wanted half of it to go to public television. She was very good friends with Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, and believed passionately in public television.
Boy, that'd buy a lot of sweaters, wouldn't it? I'm sorry. Go ahead. God, forgive
me. It would have. Yeah. It would have. And she didn't really, as many people don't, understand that there's a financial difference between public television and TV. In this state, I know it's slightly different because they are intertwined in some ways. But in any case, she wanted to give money to PBS and then to NPR. And the PBS people never returned the calls. So all of the money went to public radio, and half of it what was earmarked for public TV. So she, and it's interesting because she just left the money. She had no restrictions in, as it was with her other major gift, 10 times larger to the Salvation Army, which was restricted. It left both, as people may remember, both NPR and all the member stations who didn't, it's important to point out, receive any of that money directly. It left everybody kind of dumbfounded. It's kind of like winning the lottery. What do we do now, honey? What do we do now that we've got all this money? And so it caused a lot of consternation, happily so.
Salvation Army, forgive me for interrupting, the Salvation Army's story is really interesting because she asked them to do something they simply don't do, right? They build rec centers.
Right. Whereas the gift to NPR was unrestricted, the gift to Salvation Army was very restricted. And she had built a test center in San Diego, her last hometown. And it was a transformative center, a recreation center for poor kids, poor families in a poor neighborhood that really transformed the neighborhood. And her whole goal was to give people a place to drop their kids after school if, you know, they needed, and health and fitness and just community center. And so she asked the Salvation Army to do that, to replicate that all around the country. And they have. They've built 26 of these centers. They're magnificent, one more magnificent than the next, crown jewels in their community.
What would you say is her legacy?
You know, that probably is it, along with NPR. But I think, Frank, the bigger legacy is, you know, in our world today, everything is being cast as very black and white. There are so many shades of gray, if you will, in this story. You know, whether you love or hate McDonald's and fast food and what it's done in our culture, our society, our diet, this is an incredible story of this man who was the steward of this brand and made it an international thing. And this is the story of a woman he loved dearly who took that money and did incredible things with it. And I think that the legacy is just that confused, complex braiding of ideals. And, you know, it's just an incredible story that this woman who was not trained in any way is as magnificent as Gates and Buffett. And hopefully her name will be remembered that way.
And that story is told by Lisa Napoli, my guest, a journalist and the author of Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. Lisa, so great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Frank, so much.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about how swaths of a no man's land actually became nature preserves during the Cold War. Stay tuned.